Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and Dr. Foss is a Professor of Medical Oncology and Dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed welcomes Dr. Joachim Behring. Dr. Behring is the director of the Yale Cancer Center Brain Tumor Program, and he's an associate professor of neuro-oncology. Here's Ed Chu.
So why don't we start off by defining what brain cancer is?
Essentially, there are two types of brain cancer. Primary brain cancer, which are cancers that arise directly in the brain, and then there's metastatic brain cancer, which means cancer lesions that arise in the brain as a metastasis from a systemic tumor elsewhere in the body.
So I guess for today's discussion, we're really going to be focusing on that first type of brain cancer called primary brain cancer, but maybe I can just follow up with, you know, what are the types of other cancers that commonly spread to the brain?
You mean systemic cancers?
So yeah, the metastatic brain cancer,
right,
type.
The most common cancers that spread to the brain are breast cancer, lung cancer, and at the same time, those are the most common cancers in general. Other cancers, which are overall less common, may have a high risk of seeding to the brain. For example, malignant melanoma.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So getting back to primary brain cancer, you know, so how common is it? You know, about how many patients, you know, each year are given this diagnosis of primary brain cancer? And then I guess within primary brain cancer, I guess there are a number of different types of subcategories.
Right. There's a large number of subcategories. Overall, there are about 45,000 cases of primary brain tumors in the United States. That doesn't equal brain cancer. That includes benign tumors and cancerous tumors, malignant tumors, if you will. The most common primary brain cancer is called glioblastoma multiforme, and there are about 8,000 to 10,000 cases in the U.S. per year. And that compares to over 100,000 cases of colon cancer, over 200,000 cases of breast cancer, prostate cancer. So you can tell brain cancer is rare, fortunately. There are numerous subtypes. I mentioned the glioblastoma is the most common one. Another very common brain tumor, which is benign, is called meningioma. That is a tumor that arises from the covering of the brain and is generally curable by taking it out.
And in what age group do we typically see these brain cancers?
As other cancers, brain cancer is usually a disease of older age. So the older we get, the higher the risk is of developing brain cancer. And that applies to the most common primary brain cancers. There are exceptions. There are cancers that arise particularly at young age, in childhood. There's a tumor of the balance center of the brain called medulloblastoma, mm-hmm. which is much more common in children than it is in adults. But as a general rule, the older we are, the higher the risk is of developing brain cancer.
And so what do we know about the main risk factors for developing brain cancer?
There are very few that have been proven to lead ultimately to brain cancer. One known risk factor is exposure to radiation, therapeutic doses of radiation. So if, for example, if someone suffered from childhood leukemia and underwent radiation treatment to the whole brain, either for treating leukemia in the brain or preventing leukemia from seeding to the brain, those patients are at higher risk later in life to develop a number of brain tumors, including malignant ones, brain cancer. That's really the most solid risk factor that, uh-huh. that we know of. There are some other environmental risk factors that are discussed and investigated, or have been investigated numerous times. For probably the most, the one of most concern is exposure to cell phones. And I think we still don't have really solid data as to whether the risk for brain cancer is increased in cell phone users. And I don't think we have a good sense as to how much or cell phone use would be unhealthy. I think, as a general rule, it's reasonable to limit the exposure to cell phone or other forms of electromagnetic waves to a minimum, and use devices that limit the exposure. But again, the link really has not been established yet.
It's interesting because I guess there have been earlier studies to show that in fact there wasn't an increased risk, but I guess that was using kind of the old analog cell phones, and it wasn't clear that people were using cell phones quite as frequently as they are now. I mean, it's really pretty amazing at how young an age people are starting to use cell phones, and they seem to be on it for a long period of time.
That's true, yeah. Some people use the cell phone as their main device to make phone calls rather than just to make a quick emergency phone call on the road. But again, there's no study that would tell us how much of cell phone use is too much and whether there is an increased risk to begin with.
And what about dental x-rays? Because I know people have asked me, if they have too many dental x-rays, that could put them at increased risk. Is there any truth to that at all? Or
There is no data that would link plain x-rays for dental procedures to brain cancer. I think, as with everything, we should and do limit medical procedures, including these x-rays, to the absolute minimum. I think the current standards in terms of frequency of these x-rays is reasonable, and at that frequency, there is no clear link to brain cancer.
And is there any genetic component, any genetic basis for brain cancer? So if someone in the family has had brain cancer, does that increase the likelihood that a sibling or a child could develop brain cancer?
There are certainly genetic risk factors. However, they're rare. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of conditions. The most common one is called neurofibromatosis, and those patients have a certain gene defect that renders them susceptible of developing all kinds of tumors affecting both the peripheral and the central nervous system. In the overall scheme, though, the number of patients who develop a brain tumor based on one of those predisposition syndromes is probably less than 3%. So, and then again, cancer is common. So if a patient who has brain cancer has several family members with a cancer history, that may not be alarming to mm-hmm. begin with. Mm-hmm. If patients have the same kind of tumor, only certain types of tumor within one family, and develop these tumors at an unusual young age, then one should pursue investigation whether a predisposition exists within that family.
Great. In terms of symptoms that an individual might experience, what should one look out for?
Brain tumor symptoms are rather nonspecific. A lot of disease processes affecting the brain can present with symptoms very similar to how a brain tumor would present. The two most common initial presentations, though, are headaches and seizures. Mm-hmm. So especially if somebody has developed seizures late in life, range from above 40 years of age, I'd say, that is somewhat concerning and generally suggests that there's a structural problem within the brain, and many times that is a tumor. Headaches are obviously amongst the most common symptoms that we go seek medical advice for, and the vast majority of headache causes are benign ones. In terms of headaches, if a patient wakes up in the morning with a headache and feels nauseated, and then as the day goes on, the headache improves, mm-hmm. but then over time, week after week, month after month, those headaches get worse, that is a type of headache that is more concerning, as opposed to the tension-type headache that we all get.
Right.
That gets worse at the end of the day, and then the next morning after a good night's sleep or a massage, it's gone. That really doesn't raise any concerns.
So what period of time would you say, should one get concerned if a headache persists for more than a week or two? That doesn't seem to get better.
Yeah, it also depends a little bit on the intensity. Mm-hmm. If it's a mild, dull pain, and the patient... had a workout or did some strenuous work, some heavy lifting, then you know that kind of that kind of activity can set off a tension type headache, and that can linger on for longer. But especially if there's progression, no clear explanation for the headache, and then after a period of maybe a week or two, one should at least ask the family doctor for a checkup.
So then the next person that should be seen should be the general internist or the family physician?
I think that would be the first doctor to see, and the family doctor can first of all take a good history and do a thorough examination, and if there are certain concerning features, then maybe that doctor already would order the first imaging study or then refer the patient for a neurologic evaluation, or if there's particular concern about a tumor, then to a neuro-oncologist.
So, and again, you would recommend from the family physician then to seek attention directly to a neuro-oncologist, a specialist like yourself, as opposed to, say, a more general neurologist?
It depends a little bit on the symptoms. Frequently, it works that way. So patients have a headache that gets worse and worse, and the family doctor already orders an imaging study, and that then shows a mass lesion, and then patients are referred directly to us. If the symptoms are a little more or a little less clear, let's say a patient develops some strange sensory loss on one side of the body or something like that, then frequently the family physician refers those patients to a general neurologist to rule out neurologic conditions that are much more common than brain tumors.
And what would be the usual imaging studies, x-ray studies that would be done to try to make a diagnosis of brain cancer?
The most sensitive and specific test for diagnosing a brain tumor would be an MRI, a magnetic resonance imaging. A CAT scan serves the purpose of ruling out an acute event that would constitute an emergency, such as a stroke or a bleed within the brain. And sometimes it's used as a screening test to make sure that there's no major tumor within the brain. But really, if there is concern, then an MRI should be obtained. And those scans are done with contrast dye, and brain cancer does light up on these studies, and it's fairly easily to diagnose.
Mm-hmm. And so then once, say, something suspicious is seen on the MRI or CAT scan, what would be the next step?
Well, if there's concern for a brain tumor, then a definitive diagnosis requires that a piece of tissue is obtained from that lesion, and that requires a neurosurgical consultation. If the tumor can be removed in its entirety and it seems to be a tumor that would best be treated that way, then patients undergo full surgery and the tumor is removed to the largest possible extent without causing any injury. If the tumor is of a kind that responds favorably to chemotherapy, or if a tumor is located in a critical area of the brain where surgery would lead to a disability, then the surgical procedure may be limited to a small biopsy. And in that case, only a small burr hole is drilled into the patient's head, and then a small sample is retrieved with essentially a needle.
Maybe tell us a little bit about, you know, how you evaluate patients.
Most patients come to me referred by another physician, so they do come with imaging studies. Sometimes I'm the one who does the initial workup. But the evaluation consists of a thorough history and a physical examination, review of the imaging studies. If a surgical procedure has already been performed, we review the report first, and then refer the entire case essentially to what we call our tumor board. That is a multidisciplinary conference that takes place once a week, during which we then review the actual pathology slides. Those are sections that are performed after the tumor tissue has been removed, and then these sections are looked at under the microscope to determine what type of brain tumor it is. The treatment plan is then generated by our multidisciplinary team. There are neurosurgeons on that team, medical oncologists, neurologists, radiation oncologists, pathologists, those are doctors specialized on the analysis of the tumor tissue, and radiologists, specialists to interpret imaging studies.
Great. Well, maybe at the on the other side of the break, we can talk a little bit more about this multidisciplinary approach to treating patients with brain cancer. We're going to take a short break for Medical Minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about the evaluation and treatment of brain tumors with our guest expert, Dr. Joachim Behring from the Yale Cancer Center.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Before the break, Joachim, we were talking about the multidisciplinary approach to treating patients with brain cancer, and you were telling us about how your multidisciplinary clinic and tumor board functions. Maybe you could just, again, maybe for those who may have missed the first part of this interview, you can, again, review with us all of the different oncology disciplines that are involved in this clinic and tumor board conference.
Sure. We have two platforms, really, to provide multidisciplinary care. On one side, we have the multidisciplinary clinic, where doctors of the various subspecialties evaluate patients at the same time in the same place. And then we have the tumor board, which is a multidisciplinary conference. In our multidisciplinary clinic, we have neurosurgeons, we have a medical oncologist, a neurologist, and a radiation oncologist, and especially new patients are evaluated at the same time. So if we get a referral either for management or as a second opinion, we see these patients as a team. Mm-hmm. The tumor board then is a platform where we can discuss patients in more detail, where we can review the imaging study with one of our neuroradiologists who is a specialist on brain tumor imaging, with our neuropathologist who is the doctor who analyzes the tumor tissue. And then as a group, we can come up with a treatment plan. And that may be a standard treatment plan with an established treatment regimen, or it may be a clinical trial.
And again, maybe you can, you know, very briefly review the different types of treatments that can be offered to patients?
Most patients with brain cancer require this multidisciplinary approach. The first step is usually surgery. May that be simply to retrieve a small piece of tissue to make the diagnosis or remove the entire tumor as a first step of treatment. Then the second step of treatment depends on the type of tumor that we encounter. For many tumors, combined radiation and chemotherapy is required. For example, the most common tumor that we talked about in the first part of the interview, glioblastoma multiforme, requires both radiation and chemotherapy. The chemotherapy for that tumor comes in pill form, and then treatment is administered over a 6-week block, followed by additional chemotherapy down the line. There are other tumors. There's a tumor called primary CNS, or central nervous system lymphoma, mm-hmm. Which is exquisitely sensitive to chemotherapy. So those patients usually only undergo a biopsy and then go directly on to chemotherapy. And there are tumors that are surgically curable, such as meningioma. So these patients don't need the radiation doctor or me. And then there are tumors that are very sensitive to radiation. For example, there's a tumor of the brain that's called germinoma. It's a germ cell tumor of the brain, and that can be cured with radiation. So you can see there are algorithms in place for different types of brain tumor. And there's a large number, and every single division, a subdivision, is relatively uncommon.
Mm-hmm. Joachim, what is gamma knife? We hear that term used a lot. Is that a surgical procedure? And when would you consider using gamma knife as a treatment approach?
The name almost implies that it's a surgical procedure, but it is knifeless, although it's called gamma knife. This mm-hmm. is a radiosurgical procedure. Radiosurgery entails the administration of a very focused beam of radiation to a defined area of interest within the brain. So, for example, if a patient has a tumor that's very deep in the brain that's not considered surgically removable, a tumor that is not responsive to chemotherapy, a tumor that is no larger than about 2/3 to 1 inch in diameter. That would be an ideal target for a gamma knife radiosurgery. Patients, this is a one-day procedure, essentially. Patients come into our Gamma Knife Center. A frame is attached to the patient's head, which assures that patients are in a defined position within the device. And then after very complicated and careful planning, the radiation boosted is administered to that lesion. And that really concludes then the treatment. But there's no cutting involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've also heard the term cyberknife used. Is that the same as gamma knife, or is that slightly different?
It's similar, but not the same. Gamma knife, as I mentioned, requires that a firm frame is attached to the patient's head to make sure that the X-ray beam is truly administered to the area that is supposed to be radiated. The other techniques like cyberknife, and there are numerous other techniques and that follow the same principle. The targeting of the X-ray beam is based on plain X-rays. So X-rays are taken off the anatomical area of interest from different angles, and then through a computer algorithm, that information is used to guide the X-ray exactly to the target that's supposed to be radiated. You call that image-guided stereotactic radiosurgery, as opposed to the frame-based radiosurgery, which is gamma knife. Mm-hmm. So technically, these are different techniques. However, both serve the purpose of eradicating a very focused problem. One big difference is that the image-guided radiosurgery can be used anywhere in the body, as opposed to gamma knife, which can only be used in the head.
And presumably, I guess, by having such a focused delivery of radiation therapy, that can help to reduce, minimize the toxicity.
Absolutely. First of all, one can administer a higher dose to the cancer, meaning the cell killing will be more efficient. On the other side, the beam is so focused that the surrounding tissue is not exposed to this large dose. So that's a major advantage of these radiosurgical procedures compared to standard radiation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Jochen, maybe talk to us a little bit about the role of biological targeted therapy. You know, we hear that term used a lot for the treatment of a wide range of other cancers, but as I understand it now, really targeted therapy has also now come to the treatment of brain cancer.
Yeah, that is an extremely exciting area of research. And as you mentioned, many of these treatment concepts have already found their place in standard treatment protocols or clinical trials. Quote-unquote targeted therapy means that tumor cells are attacked through specific growth-promoting or growth-inhibiting mechanisms. Now, it's not like the more old-fashioned chemotherapeutic agents are untargeted. Mm-hmm. They have different targets. Maybe some of the newer agents are specifically targeted to one specific molecule. For example, in brain cancer, growth of brain cancer many times is driven by a receptor molecule on the surface of these cells. It's called EGFR, or epidermal growth factor receptor. Now, there are targeted therapies available that specifically render this receptor dysfunctional and thus decrease the flow of signal through this growth-promoting pathway. Now, that is not unique to brain cancer. These drugs were developed first for lung cancer and other types of systemic cancer, but many of these treatment concepts do apply to brain cancer as well. There's another targeted form of treatment that doesn't attack the tumor itself. It attacks the tumor's ability to form new blood vessels. You call that anti-angiogenic therapies. And there are numerous mechanisms at various levels that one can use, and that is one of the most exciting new treatment forms for cancer in general and for brain cancer specifically.
And in fact, Avastin, which is kind of right. The main antibody that's used to treat colon cancer, lung cancer, breast cancer, as I understand it, was recently approved to treat.
That's true.
Glioma.
Yeah, bevacizumab the brand name is Avastin. Targets a molecule called VEGF, vascular endothelial growth factor, a protein that's required to form new blood vessels by the tumor, and that was approved by the FDA in May of this year for relapsed glioblastoma, meaning glioblastoma that has failed the first line attack, which is radiation and chemotherapy with a drug called temozolomide.
And how is, say, this drug Avastin handled? Are there many side effects associated with it?
It's actually fairly well tolerated. Avastin and other drugs within that group can increase the blood pressure, and sometimes patients have to be started on a medication to lower the blood pressure. It can have an effect on the kidney, limiting the dose of the Avastin, and it can cause wound healing problems. But in general, it is fairly well tolerated across all age groups that we treat.
Now, I know you and your group at the Yale Cancer Center have been very interested in developing new approaches to treat brain cancer. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's going on in that area.
We have a number of investigators at Yale who are interested in developing new treatment strategies for brain cancer. And there's one group that is interested in using viruses, genetically modified viruses, to specifically attack and kill brain tumor cells. That is a group led by Tony Fundenpole in the Department of Neurosurgery. We have a wonderful department led by Mark Salzman, the biomedical engineering, and his group is trying to develop particles. They call them nanoparticles because they're microparticles that can be administered directly into the brain and then slowly release a therapeutic agent. May that be a classical chemotherapy agent or one of the newly developed agents. And it is our hope that with these nanoparticles, we can deliver a higher concentration of compounds directly into the brain, not exposing the rest of the body to the possible side effects from these drugs.
So these nanoparticles would be administered by a neurosurgeon who would kind of place
in all
them?
Likelihood, one could probably generate nanoparticles that can be given by vein. However, then one would have to worry about whether these particles can make it into the brain tumor and systemic side effects to the whole body. One way to administer these drugs would be through direct infusion into the brain. Mm. So at the time the tumor is taken out, the neurosurgeon would insert microcatheters into the normal brain surrounding the tumor, and then drug would be infused through an infusion pump through these catheters directly into the brain and into the brain tumor.
Wow, that's pretty fascinating.
It is. It's called convection-enhanced delivery, and we were involved in one of the earliest clinical trials that used this technique first in humans.
And it's interesting because there are these wafers that contain chemotherapy that are already approved for treating patients with brain cancer.
That's true. That was really the first concept where chemotherapy was directly administered into the brain, and Dr. Salzman was actually instrumentally involved in the development of these wafers. These are dime-sized discs, essentially, that are impregnated with a chemotherapy compound that's called carmarthen or BCNU, and it's attached to the wall of the cavity that the surgeon creates when he takes out the tumor, and then over the course of a few days, that chemotherapy drug diffuses into the normal brain surrounding the brain tumor and kills any tumor cells that were not removed at the time of surgery.
It's fascinating. So it'll be very interesting to hear more when we get you back for a future show. And then, are there any clinical trials that you folks are involved with that particularly excited about?
We have a number of clinical trials. We completed a couple of trials recently. One used a tumor-directed vaccine, essentially a vaccine that stimulates the immune system to target the brain tumor. Another clinical trial used one of those anti-angiogenic compounds that we talked about earlier, so a drug that interferes with the tumor's ability to form new blood vessels. Currently, we just launched a new trial in the setting of one of the national consortia, the Radiation Therapy Oncology Group, that uses the current standard treatment, which is radiation and a drug called temozolomide after surgery, in conjunction with one of these anti-angiogenic compounds, the bevacizumab or Avastin.
Great. Well, we look forward to having you back on a future show. We can hear more about the progress being made in the trial and all of the really exciting research that's going on with your group.
It would be my pleasure.
Until next week, this is Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have any questions or would like to share your comments, you can go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.